Hey, Renu.
Hi, Declan. It's good to be back home.
Yeah, we've just been at the USANS meeting, which is our annual scientific meeting down in Adelaide. That was good fun.
It was really fun. Fun-filled, hard-working 4 days, but it was great.
Well done to conveners Michael Cheung and
Dixon Woon, yep. And all eyes on Perth 2025 to Shane LaBianca and Trent Barrett.
So if you haven't been to the USANS annual scientific meeting, it's a great meeting. It's a kind of medium-sized meeting, 1,000-odd people, but I think we have 14 or 15 international faculty. It is a really enjoyable meeting.
It is, and I think one of the highlights is the selection of international faculty. And, you know, over the 4 days, you really get to spend a lot of time with them, get to know them quite well. And, in fact, you get a little bit of withdrawal when you leave the meeting. So it's wonderful when one of them follows us back home.
As they did this time, as it turns out.
Yes, Professor Neil Fleshner is here with us. Hello. In the flesh in our GUCAR studio. Professor of Urology from Toronto. Neil, welcome.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here in your fine city and your fine country. So it's great.
But you're no stranger to Australia, right?
I am not. I've been about 5 times or so. Wow. So that's great.
But it is so great to have you here. And and you were such a highlight at the meeting for several reasons. This is going to be great.
Good. Let's have some fun.
Let's have some fun.
So this is one of our themed podcasts, as regular listeners and viewers will know. GUCAST is supported by a partnership program. We have some superb partners from across the GU oncology industry, pharmaceutical companies, device companies, who help us put on this for free, so we can bring it for free to you all. And this week, one of our bronze partners, Cipla Pharmaceuticals here in Australia. They're actually a big global company out of India, but Cipla support a lot of GU oncology here, and their main product is Firmagon. So they're supporting this product because we've got two things we want to talk about today. The first of which is, ADT, and how do we select patients? How do we make sure that the ADT that we're prescribing is safe for patients? We want to talk about cardiovascular risks, etc. But the second bit of the podcast, and please stick around for it, is nothing to do with GU oncology, really, per se. We want to talk to Dr. Fleshner about innovation, entrepreneurship in general.
Very exciting.
Yeah, because he has some really, really, really great stories to tell about
personal insights, which we're looking forward to hearing.
Please stick around for that. So, and thanks to our friends at Cipla for partnering with us on this. We are an independent clinician-led podcast, so they don't pre-approve any of this, but because we have these joint areas of interest in GU oncology, they're very happy to partner with us. But Renu, so first of all, we want to chat about ADT and cardiovascular.
Yeah, you know, it's such an important thing to discuss because, you know, we've come a long way in prostate cancer research, and now we've got great evidence supporting duplet therapy, triplet therapy, you know, lutetium PSMA, but the underlying common denominator for all of these treatments is still ADT.
Exactly. So out there all the time here in Australia, around the world, many of you listeners and viewers are having men come into your clinic, whether they're newly diagnosed metastatic or we've treated them before, but now they've got metastases. And we reach for most often a prescription for ADT. In many of the regions we speak to, it can be surgery. But especially for the patients who are being prescribed ADT, LHRH analogs or GnRH antagonists are in our armamentarium. And one way or the other, I think, Neil, something that we as urologists and radiation oncologists don't always appreciate is the fact that these drugs have predictable cardiovascular side effects. And maybe, first of all, we don't always understand the baseline risk for patients. So we wanted to ask you, first of all, about that. You know, we're always very liberal. You got this positive scan. Your PSA is 100. Let's take a script out and get you going on some ADT. We're going to get that PSA under control. We're going to get your symptoms under control. But do we really dig in and understand
the patient? No. I mean, it's a great question. We don't dig in enough. And I think when you recognize that men need ADT, let's face it, they need it for their cancers. They need it for their prostate cancer. But aside from, you know, the men who need ADT are aging men. And aging men have other comorbidities, particularly cardiovascular. And not only that, the ADT doesn't only increase the risk of the cardiovascular, but also increases the metabolic syndrome, which then increases the risk of the cardiovascular. So we need, I think, when you prescribe a drug, you have an obligation to really look at what you're doing, what are the side effects, and in my view, be either prepared to interact and mitigate them, or at least refer on to somebody who can. And I think cardiovascular risk, there's no doubt, is inherent in giving ADT. Aging men need testosterone. We take it away, it's not a great thing. So we need to be aware of risk factors, pre-existing risk factors, obviously the classic ones, hypertension, cholesterol, diabetes, pre-diabetes, sedentary life, smoking. But we also, and we need to take that into account. And I think now the evidence suggests that, you know, if we do that, we could actually minimize the adverse effects of it. So I think that's really important. So it's not just a fait accompli. It's something that we can do something
but
about.
But it seems hard, Neil, you know, for a urologist to, you know, when you're in a busy practice and you've got 20 patients in clinic and you've got someone on ADT, what are the pertinent questions to ask? What, how do you assess for their cardiovascular risk?
Well, a couple of things. You know, I think it's really important to recognize as a clinician, if you prescribe a drug and Mr. Smith doesn't show up 3 months later because, and then you find out he's had a stent put in, you usually, you don't make a connection
between the prescription and that event.
And similarly, because they're ultimately not that common. And secondly, if somebody doesn't show up, you usually don't know why they didn't show up. Or if somebody says, you know, I had a stent put in, it's 2 weeks ago, you'll say, you don't make the connection. So you can't recognize side effects that are uncommon to your treatment in your practice because it tends to be a small part of a numerator denominator thing. So first of all, so all you could do is be proactive in my view. So you need to say, okay, it's very simple, a basic screen, right? Just ask for a history of heart disease, ask for a history of aortic disease, ask for a history of diabetes. I mean, this is all basic med school 101 stuff. We all know risk factors for cardiovascular disease. And I think to suggest that urologists can't do it is an insult to our field. We're all pretty smart people. Everyone's done well in school. And this is basic GP work. Mm-hmm. So to say that we can't do it is, in my view, insulting. We can do it, and it's an obligation to do it. So absolutely. I think it is important.
And are there any situations in which you think that someone's risk factors are too great to preclude ADT at all? Have you had that situation, and how do you deal
with
that?
I've never. I mean, there's no doubt there may be patients, you know, there are many patients when you can anticipate they're going to need ADT in the future. The obvious one is a patient who's got a PSA recurrence after surgery and a radiation, and the PSA is slowly creeping up. And you're saying, like, Mr. Jones, in the next year, two, three, you may need ADT. And that's a great opportunity to do what I call prehab.
Absolutely.
Right? Like, lose some weight, because it's going to be really hard to do it when you're on the drugs. But in addition to that, if a man needs ADT, if they've got cord compression, if they have pain, they need the drug. It's simple. There's no other treatment for prostate cancer that is nearly equally efficacious than just good old-fashioned LHRH therapy or castration. So we're stuck with it. And I think all we can do is try our best in those cases to give the drug and simultaneously pull in, either manage it ourselves or pull in the people who need it, who can help us and help the patient.
So that's clearly one aspect, is optimizing your patient who's come in, he's got this diagnosis of prostate cancer, but let's, you know, as caring physicians, figure out what else is going on with this patient. And I remember Peter Albertson's systematic review from many years ago showed that it's about like 30-35% of patients who have one of these underlying risk factors.
Correct.
Some of them greater than others, but like, it is a very, very common thing. So having approach the patient-related factors, see, have we optimized that? Have they seen their primary care physician or their cardiologist? When it comes down to the ADT then, this has been an interesting story over the past 10 years, is what about the risk with LHRH analogs compared to GnRH antagonists like Degarelix? Because, you know, there are a few benefits from that therapy. One of the putative ones in the early days was there may be less like plaque disruption or other
related
things that
to
might
FSH.
Be triggered. Yeah. So what are your thoughts?
So it's a controversial and remains a controversial topic in our field. There's no doubt that cardiovascular risk is up in those patients. That the Albertson analysis you referred to was a sort of a secondary analysis, a pooled analysis from randomized trials, sort of aggregated. And I think what it showed was those, particularly as you mentioned, with pre-existing cardiovascular disease, seemed to do better with a antagonist and an agonist. And I think that was also somewhat reinforced in the HERO trial, right, where an oral antagonist did have lower amounts, particularly of grade 1 and 2 major cardiac events. There was, of course, however, and credit to the folks who make Firmagon, Ferring, they actually did a trial, the PRONOUNCE trial, and it was a large randomized trial, very rarely done in medicine and by pharma companies, which was sort of a trial to look at the outcomes. And that trial was largely negative. I think we have to be clear. It couldn't accrue patients, arguably underpowered, but largely disappointing. However, in that trial, as you can imagine, given the way ethics boards work, is the patient had to get their risk factors modified. So in addition to being put on an agonist or an antagonist, you also had your cholesterol dealt with. You also had your hypertension dealt with. So I think the message is, I think the best evidence today would suggest that if you're well managed medically, it probably doesn't matter. But the reality is most men aren't. So given there's a lot of chaos in our worlds and men are generally hopeless at this, I think the evidence would suggest that if you're not being adequately managed, it probably certainly wouldn't hurt and may help to use an antagonist as opposed to an agonist. Right? That's the way I summarize the existing literature on this.
Yeah, good points, isn't it?
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think the message for the audience out there is, number one, assess your patient very carefully.
That's the most important.
It is the most important thing.
That's the most, because you are aggravating their cardiac risk. Let's face it, right? So, you know, and in my particular practice, I'm very passionate about this. Like, I prescribe, we measure every year in our clinic a lipid profile. We check a blood pressure every so often. We measure hemoglobin A1C. And I actually, maybe uniquely, manage that myself. I'll prescribe metformin. I'll prescribe Crestor. I'll prescribe an ARB if I need to. Now, that may be a little too far for most urologists, but for me, it's a personal thing, and I like to do it. But I think, you know, many urologists don't have that gumption or time. Most of the work I'm doing is done by a physician assistant, frankly, not me. It's under my guidance. So if you're busy and working, you might not have time, but at least align with somebody who can help you, whether it's a cardio-oncologist, and there is a burgeoning field in cardio-oncology, or if not, a fantastic primary care doctor. But if they can't, like most men are useless, we're terrible. I'm speaking now, Declan, like you and me, like we don't really look after ourselves as good as we should. And that's probably like most of our patients. So it wouldn't hurt to use an antagonist, I think, because that PRONOUNCE trial didn't really finish.
But Declan, that's a good point, isn't it? I mean, we talk a lot about the importance of multidisciplinary care in prostate cancer, and what are your thoughts on the embedding of a cardiologist into the prostate cancer world?
But look, I mean, for most of the time, getting access to a cardiologist in many health systems, our systems here in Australia included, is like a pipe dream. These folk are busy doing their own stuff. But actually, just as Neil hinted at, because of this new field of cardio-oncology, it's not so much for our ADT patients, it's because so many of these new, powerful, amazing drugs we have, like checkpoint inhibitors, do have a lot of cardio toxicity. Yeah.
So, and by the way, as we further suppress the androgen axis with the ARPIs, there's even a greater burden. If you actually look at the cardiac effects in some of the M0, for example, CRPC trials, the Spartan, Prosper, Arisense trials, you will see, if you look carefully in the AE chart, that there's a higher risk of cardiac events in those who are, again, have their androgen axis furtherly suppressed. Yeah. So now that men, you know, when you think about things like EMBARK, or now we may enter this era where men on ARPIs for 5-10 years could happen, I think it's almost going to become more important. So I think the importance of this topic is only going to grow. It's not going to actually go away.
Yeah. And we do, therefore, have better access, actually, than we used to. But I think a lot of it is still primary care. And I don't prescribe statins like you do. And I suspect many of the younger listeners.
It's very easy.
But yeah.
C-R-E-S-T-O-R.
And by the way, do you check the LFTs like a few months later and stuff? He's a proper old doctor.
I
want Dr. Fletcher to look after me when I'm old.
But hang on, if you're on abiraterone, you're checking the LFTs anyway. So it's like on our sheet. It's not that hard to do.
And the other field that have boomed in the cancer center since is gastroenterologists as well, because of, again, all the enteric complications of the checkpoint inhibitors.
Exactly.
But before we finish on this topic, I mean, traditionally, the reason that a lot of us have used the antagonist is that classic patient who comes in the door with painful bone metastases, PSA 1,000, their terrible back pain, and, you know, and they're the ones you used to take to the OR to do an orchidectomy on in the old days, and across Asia-Pacific, of course, that's still a main tool for ADT. But I think what I used to do in the early days was I used to sort of use Degarelix for that reason, I'd say.
Always.
But there aren't that many of those patients, but it was so enjoyable. And I remember one of the first times I prescribed that drug, getting a phone call a few hours later from the patient's daughter because she'd had my mobile number. I thought, oh, bugger, what's happened to this nice man? I just wanted to ring you to say his pain has gone away.
He's great.
It's 7 o'clock in the evening. So we still have that, but it's, I suppose it's over the last 10 years I've begun to reflect a lot more on the cardiovascular risk thing. So now I use that drug a lot more for
I think we didn't care about this. Yeah, like we didn't care about this 20 years ago because the patients lived like 2-3 years.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
right. Now, although the evidence is many of the cardiac events occur in the first year, funnily enough, but that aside, men now are going to be living 5-10 years.
Yeah.
On even with metastatic disease, we're now at the sort of, right, the 60-month rate. And it's only going to get better and longer, so we have to pay more attention to what we're doing.
That's why I think you're right about the AR pathway inhibitors, because traditionally the reason why asking the question about the baseline risk is important is because they're the ones that get the event within a year because they have underlying plaque formation, et cetera, et cetera.
Of course.
You know, ADT doesn't like directly cause people who are very well with no cardiovascular, they don't get an event within a year. Correct. It's the ones with, even if the event was well controlled, they had a stent 2 years ago,
yep.
They're the ones that get an event within a year. But you're right, because they're not all dying within 2 or 3 years now, they're on AR pathway inhibitors, there's a secondary risk about being on this whole ADT, older patient, AR pathway
inhibitor. It's sort of a cancer survivorship issue, isn't it?
And it, you know, and even if it's not ADT that we're focusing on, even if it's, you know, something as simple as exercise physiology, which now has become a, you know, huge focus in managing metastatic prostate cancer, you really do have to assess their cardiovascular risk, even if it is exercise that you're prescribing.
Right.
So should we go on and talk about the other thing?
Oh, exciting.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So Neil was down in Australia this week and you had a few great lectures on different aspects of oncology, but you did a great talk at the end of the conference on innovation and entrepreneurship. And just by way of a little bit of background, I think you've set up two interesting companies over recent years, but one of them we've had an interest in, Point Biopharma, because of our interest in radioligand therapy, as regular viewers and listeners will know about. And Point Biopharma was set up by Neil and co 4 or 5 years ago to develop a novel radioligand therapy and develop clinical trials. The SPLASH trial, which is coming to maturity, and his company has become very successful. It's floated on the stock exchange. It's been acquired recently by Eli Lilly. So it's a very profitable business. And the other company, I think, was in BCG, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly.
So what we want to pick your brains on is to tell us a little bit about the story of your journey towards developing successful companies.
Right.
And tips, I suppose, and tricks for listeners and viewers out there.
I don't know that there's any tips, except maybe I can motivate people to say that I think anybody could do this. So, you know, I think both of these companies were born out of frustration with our system. The first was born out of, and just to be clear, I've been an academic professorial, right? Still writing grants, big research group. Like I still do that. And I'm a kind of a nerdy geek that way. But I don't like no for an answer, I think. And I think a lot of surgeons are like that, frankly. And it all started probably about 6 or 7 years ago when we had a BCG shortage in Canada. Merck and Sanofi were both making the drugs. Sanofi had a problem in their plant, which actually was made in Toronto, half hour from our hospital. And they basically closed down their whole BCG franchise. And that left us with one supplier. And then that supplier could not ramp up their supply for Canada and the U.S., frankly. And the question, and then it got bizarre. You know, how do you ration a drug, particularly we're in the first world, we're in Canada. We have a drug that if you have carcinoma in situ, cures like 70% of patients. And if it doesn't work, you kind of lose your bladder, at least back then. So I thought this was horrible. And we started rationing the drug. We were giving like a tenth of the dose, you know, to people, or a third of the dose. And you know, there was some evidence justifying. But at the end of the day, I really got a bad taste in my mouth.
Yeah.
And I ran into an old friend who was in the business. And we talked. And we actually formed a company to basically import BCG to Canada. And now we... And that was the fodder for the company. And now we own about half of the market share in Canada. And we've now expanded to Puerto Rico and the U.S. And it's like a real thing. There's about 70 employees. And it's kind of fun. And it's an alternative to what we do. Around the same time, I, as being an avant-garde practitioner, you think writing Crestor is avant-garde, I got interested in some of these crazy case reports coming out of Germany with lutetium PSMA. And, you know, there's these case reports, I'm sure you've all seen it, these case reports in the nuclear medicine journals of men looking like Dalmatian dogs on PSMA scans, and they get treated, and most, and they're disease melts away. And I had a few wealthy and well-to-do patients who basically had no treatment options. And I said, listen, if you wish, I'll take you to Germany. I'll be your fit personal physician for a week. Let's go. We'll get you treated. So I took, escorted two patients. This was in January 9, 2019 to Berlin, and we got them treated. And even though I was their physician, I was doing nothing. I was just hanging out. We were having dinners and glasses of wine. But the reality was, during the day, they were doing it as an inpatient as well. But so once they got started, I took all that time and just started learning from on the back end. How do you make it? How does this work? What's the scan? It was totally new to me. You know, we're not really trained in nuclear medicine. You guys are way ahead of us. And I came back home and I said, I went to the head of the cancer center. I said, we need to start a lutetium program here. I've got a donor. Let's get it going. One of the gentlemen gave me a few million dollars. And I kept getting the roadblocks. And I've started big programs in our hospital. And I was getting things. What were they saying? They were saying, this is too early. They had a fledgling lutetium dotatate program. They said, let's wait for the results of that. Urology shouldn't be doing this. It should be nuclear med or radiation oncology or med onc. I didn't like that one. So I kept getting the gears, and it started to frustrate me. So again, that's the common theme. But as part of this journey, I said to myself, well, how am I actually going to get this drug to patients? Because you can't take the pills off the shelf. They have half-lives. They decay. Okay. So I started looking around. I said, who in this neighborhood of my city is going to be able to make and distribute this? And it turned out that literally like 40 minutes down the road in Hamilton, Ontario, there was an incubated company, a non-for-profit, that was like a world expert in contract manufacturing of both PET tracers, but also therapeutic isotopes. And they were shipping them around the world. So even though Canadian patients weren't benefiting from that, there was the expertise in my backyard. So I took their CEO with, he and I went out for dinner one night, had a couple of bottles of wine, talked about life. And I said, you know, we just kind of gelled. And then about a week later, we had a board meeting for company number one I just told you about. And I said, at the end of the board meeting, to sort of any other business, I said, guys, I just got back from Germany. I've been talking. I gave a little presentation to my board of directors. And everybody said, this is interesting. And basically, we decided to spin Point off as a subsidiary of the company one. And then eventually we just went on our own. So Joe McCann, who was the CEO of that startup incubator company, the non-for-profit, became our CEO. And we raised money. We went to Germany, bought some molecules from great scientists. And then away we went, raised some money, got into trials, bought a building in Indianapolis, started, we developed the most sophisticated plant in the world for radiopharmaceutical assembly, and A to B to C, we ended up with, and then here you go. We just got taken over as a platform company by Eli Lilly, who wanted to, like, it's a growing field and you needed to have a footprint in that space. So that's the story. Anybody can do this. I'm telling you.
He keeps saying anybody can do this.
No, but it's born out of frustration, curiosity, and just a can-do mentality. I think if your institution is making you do, I call it the shoulder shrug sign. Some people, to me, it means some people have kind of given up the oomph for the reason we're here. We're here to innovate and make people's lives better. That's what I think a healer physician should do. So, you know, I don't like no. I love trying to figure out a solution that works around the no.
But it seems to me, Neil, the number one challenge is coming up with that idea, that novel idea, that area of need, right? That no one else has thought of. You had this big BCG shortage in Canada. No one else thought of importing BCG.
Because other people will take no for an answer.
Right.
It's as simple as
that.
They
didn't go through the hurdles.
Right? Like, because I think some people say, like, okay, this is what it is. I'll give my patients a tenth of the dose or a third of the dose. I just wasn't happy for that. I think at the heart of it is entrepreneurship is solving a problem. Mm. Because the only thing that has value is something that frustrates, or you know, you make life better in some little way for the human condition. That's the essence of entrepreneurship. And I think as urologists, we're naturally curious. We naturally innovate. You know, all the robot, remember the robot was originally, what, for heart, I think, surgery was developed. And it was taken over by urology because we're incredibly creative. So I honestly feel that any urologist, we're particularly good. We're also very independent-minded. And I think that's a great, you know, the radoncs and the medoncs are more, frankly, more the analogy, like we're like herding pigs or herding cats, and they're like, you know, like horses. And it's and we need them all, but I think we have a different mindset.
It's amazing. And for people out there listening, and Renu just asked the question, how do you come up with the idea? But if you listen very carefully to what he said, these two great ideas, and by the way, the second one led to a $1.4 billion acquisition of Point by Lilly. So this is like not small time, it's big time. Yeah. Both of them came out of frustration in a clinical urology environment. So ask yourself this question as you're out there, finished a day's work in Europe or Asia, Africa, South, wherever you are. Was there something that frustrated you at work today and that frustrates you all the time?
And you know, keep taking no for an answer?
It's a BCG shortage.
You're not the only one.
You're not the only one. And so I love the simplicity of your message. Yeah. And of course, it's very modest to say that. But there's something in that that, you know, smart people listen and watch these podcasts. What are the frustrations you have at work, like Neil Fleischner had? And then, you know, have a think about how can I fix this? You know, you're smart people. And okay, maybe it'll help that there's a donor that'll help with this or that. But there are also people out there who want ideas from frustrated clinicians and nurses and 100%. So on.
There's a whole world of capital, access to capital. Yeah. There's a lot of grants and a lot of governments want to stimulate entrepreneurs. I mean, my story would have been a death knell for my academic career 15, 20 years ago. Now, ironically, I'm asked to speak about it everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, it's so weird. You know, I gave a keynote speech on medical entrepreneurship to the USC School of Management, the Anderson School, about a year ago. So it's so funny how new timing never hurts, but new opportunities have also been afforded to me, which I think is great.
Neil, you're so well connected, but what is your advice to those who maybe have a great idea but don't know where to start? What are their, you know, steps 1, 2, and 3?
Well, I think step one is don't tell the whole world about it.
Okay. Good advice.
So be very selective in who and then secondly, try and find a co-conspirator.
Okay.
I use that term obviously a little bit tongue in cheek, but somebody who can work on this with you. Mm-hmm. And we're all busy clinicians. I think if one of my red flags is if the owner, inventor, idea generator is also the CEO, because we're all so busy, then you can't do this part-time. And you've really, you know, entrepreneurship's about risk. You have to put your money in, you have to put your time in, and you have to make it a focus of your life. Or you better hire somebody to do that. I couldn't do that, but I was fortunate enough to have the right people around me who could and wanted to do that. So there is access to capital out there. But usually it starts with a friends and family idea. I mean, I hate to say it, but your seed money is generally friends and family.
Can we ask you finally, what next for you personally? You're on a bit of a sabbatical, I think, at the moment.
Yes.
But actually, listening to all your other lectures this week, you're still so actively involved in neoadjuvant studies for high-risk prostate cancer. You had another amazing talk on diversity in prostate cancer in Canada, different subpopulations. It looks like your passion for those things aren't changing, but give us a little idea about what's ahead next.
You know what? I'm taking life sort of a few months at a time. I still love my academic work. I have a very large and productive research group, and frankly, I could have gone to work full-time in industry, and I just don't think that's for me. So I want to go back, and I want to keep publishing. And who knows, maybe one day another idea will pop up that'll end up a company. But right now, I'm just really focusing on enjoying the moment, because it's been a fun ride, particularly with the sabbatical sort of tied in perfect timing. And then in the fall, when I go back to work as a clinician, like a lot of my patients miss me. You know, I still get a lot of emails, and it's hard not to answer them.
Yeah. Well, it's been such a pleasure having you, Neil. And I mean, you continue to inspire so many of us. I mean, not just with all of this, but you've been a role model for so many of our, young consultants who've been fellows with you in Toronto and continue.
And actually,
to do
when
very
you
well.
Think about it, a couple of his people who've done clinical fellowships with you had a bit of an entrepreneurial streak, like Joseph.
Yes.
He was in Vancouver.
Yeah,
he was in Vancouver.
But he's doing a great job.
And
Nathan definitely has. He's a guy who gets frustrated at work. I can tell you for people who work with him.
He's got the same DNA for sure.
He has, he's come up with some good ideas, and he's got one thing he's commercializing. I think that. Go and do a fellowship in GU Oncology and Entrepreneurship in Toronto. I might do it myself. Might apply myself.
Yeah, we might.
Come
apply
on, anyone wants to come. But it actually raises good questions. Maybe we should develop a fellowship. You actually just gave me a great idea. Yeah. It's yours. But maybe we should develop, sort of a fellowship where you can actually, join a startup and spend some time.
Because there's quite a bit of focus on this in, say, the Prostate Cancer Foundation retreat. Mm-hmm. There's always a talk on, how to interact with pharma, but how to do a startup, how to start it from scratch. But we don't really have that focus in Australia. So that's why it's been great to have you out here speaking.
Yeah, but I've been impressed with some of the things I saw at the meeting. Mm-hmm. I don't know, I met quite a few people who were sort of surgeon entrepreneurs. So I think it's probably, frankly, better than Canada, from what I've seen.
There you go, listeners. Don't lose hope. Have hope. I love the simple message. Anyone can do it. It's born out of clinical conundrum. So as you hang up this podcast, have a think.
Be a surgeon, scientist, entrepreneur.
What has frustrated you at work this week? And then don't just put up with it or whinge about it.
Do find something a solution. About it. Fix
exactly.
It.
That's all we have time for on this episode of GUcast. Thanks again to our friends at Cipla for bringing Neil out this week and for having us talk about cardiovascular disease.
We look forward to dinner with you, Neil.
We certainly do. All right. And a glass of wine. Take care. Thank you very much.